This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. America is a land of immigrants, but what is it like to be newly arrived? This afternoon, we'll talk about the experience with Bit Minh Nguyen. Her family left Vietnam in the spring of 1975 and settled that summer in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Bit Minh Nguyen is the author of a memoir about her experience growing up in a Vietnamese family in America. The title is Stealing Buddha's Dinner. Here's an excerpt from the book. I came of age in the 1980s before diversity and multicultural awareness trickled into Western Michigan, before ethnic was cool, before Thai restaurants became staples in every town. When I think of Grand Rapids, I remember city signs covered in images of rippling flags proclaiming an all-American city. A giant billboard looming over the downtown freeway boasted the slogan to all who drove the three-lane S-curve. As a kid, I couldn't figure out what all-American was supposed to mean. Was it a promise, a threat, a warning? That from Stealing Buddha's Dinner. Listeners, I look forward to your participation in the conversation this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Bit Minh Nguyen teaches literature and creative writing at Purdue University. She lives with her husband, novelist Porter Shreve, in Chicago and in West Lafayette. Stealing Buddha's Dinner has been awarded the Penn Gerard Fund Award. The publisher is Viking. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Bit, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, my pleasure, to have you on the program this afternoon. To begin, would you tell us the story of how your family was able to leave Vietnam and who was able to leave?
Well, my father and his brothers were all in the South Vietnamese Army, and he had three brothers, and one of them was killed. And my father and his brothers were going to stay and fight to the end, as everyone else was going to. But there came a time when everyone realized that it was over, and you could either stay, or staying meant, you know, probably being sent to a re-education camp or something worse, or you could leave. The problem was leaving was difficult because they didn't have any connections to get on any planes or helicopters or ships. So my uncle, who worked in the Navy, he sort of overheard, he got wind of the last Vietnamese Army or Navy boats waiting at the Saigon River, and they had been stationed there waiting to leave at the last second because they knew the North Vietnamese communists would be arriving. And he somehow got word to my father and their other brother. And it was a very chaotic time. It was very last second. We left on April 29th, which was the day before Saigon fell, and literally had to leave, you know, with a very, very few minutes notice, and, you know, couldn't be in contact with anybody. Now, the problem was, at the time, I was 8 months old. Mm-hmm. My sister, An, was a year and a half older, but our mother was separated from our father at the time, and she was living kind of far away in the city with her parents, and she was not able to be contacted. My father couldn't contact her and also didn't have the time or ability to contact her, and he knew he had to make a choice of leaving or trying to contact her, and the choice he made was to leave because he knew that it was our last chance.
Yeah, must have been a very difficult decision for him.
Yeah, it's really unimaginable to me having to make that decision, being in that moment. And I think that he felt that the lives of his children, their future, meant more to him than anything else.
It's
so,
awesome.
I mean, I'm really amazed whenever I'm still amazed right now thinking about that moment.
It's also difficult to imagine the heartbreak that your mother endured, finding everyone gone.
Yeah, and I didn't hear about that until I was about 20 years old. First time I talked to her, really. And she told me that story and how it was for her on the other side days after we had left. And she didn't know we had left.
Hmm.
And she finally was able to get back to my father's house. And we had all left. And she was so shocked. And nobody had left her a note. She was very fixated on the fact that no one had left her a note.
Hmm. Are you close with your mother?
No, not really. I'm not. And part of the reason, I think, is because I didn't meet her until I was 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always a mother in my life, my stepmother, who entered our lives when I was 3 years old. I wasn't missing a maternal figure.
Yeah. You've been blessed with some wonderful women in your life.
Yeah, I have. And it's interesting because writing this book, I didn't, in a way, realize how much the book was going to be about women and matriarchy and girls and friendship.
Well, tell us a little bit about your grandmother, your father's mother, who came with you, your father and his brothers, and, I think one of the so-called uncles is actually a friend of one of your uncles.
Right, yeah. Well, we call them uncle. We thought he was our uncle for a long time.
Yeah. But
my grandmother, we call her Noi, which is the Vietnamese word for paternal grandmother. My grandmother had already left her home once before in 1954. She was born and grew up in Hanoi. And when partition happened, she and her husband and her four young sons fled Hanoi to start over again in Saigon. But shortly after, pretty soon after they arrived in Saigon and were really struggling to get by, her husband died. And she was, in her 20s, and she had four young boys, and she really had to, work night and day to keep the family together. She would sell pho, which is Vietnamese soup, and on the street corners, and sort of run a makeshift restaurant from her house and do whatever she could to keep the family going. So she did an awful lot of cooking.
Does she still do a lot of cooking?
Yeah, she does. She cooks almost every day, and she's 86 years old.
Yeah. Tell us what it's like to cook with her.
Well, of course she doesn't use recipes.
Right.
And so whenever I'm trying to figure out how she cooks something, it's sort of frantic for me because I'm following her around trying to figure out measurements. And she gets a big kick out of it. She thinks it's really funny that I'm trying to measure things that she's never measured, in her life. And that's just not what cooking is for her.
Yeah.
It's just so natural for her.
Yeah.
So we have, for me, it shows how sort of Americanized I am in comparison to her experience.
Yeah.
And that's, that's a contrast that is sometimes heartbreaking.
Mm. Now tell us about Rosa.
My stepmother, Rosa. Mm-hmm. Rosa is Mexican-American, from a Mexican-American family, and her parents were migrant workers in Michigan. They had come to Michigan from Texas. She's from a very large family, 10 siblings. And she met my father when I was about 3 years old, and they married pretty soon after, within the year after they met. And so she very quickly entered my consciousness and really changed our lives. Because before we met her, we didn't know so many basic things about how to function in the American world. You know, about school and, you know, going to the dentist.
Did her entrance into the family lead to any upset in terms of your grandmother's position in the house?
No, not that I could tell, because my stepmother Rosa was always extremely respectful of my grandmother, and my grandmother was the head of the household in that she was the oldest, and the person who's the eldest is the one who gets the most respect. And, you know, she would always sit at the head of the table, and that was our norm. And my stepmother was respectful of that, so they got along very well. And Rosa also she worked a lot, and, you know, went to night school as well. And I think it was also great for her that my grandmother was there to do most of the cooking and take care of us kids. So having my grandmother there made the family a lot more stable.
Hmm. How did Rosa view the mad dash for fitting in, for assimilation?
Well, we had a lot. My stepmother, Rosa, and I had a lot of conflict because we had very different views on assimilation. Well, mine have changed, but back then, in the 80s, when I was a child, all I wanted was to fit in, was to assimilate, and more than assimilate, become someone else. And my stepmother was not of that opinion at all. She was very liberal, strong-minded. I mean, I respect her enormously. But at the time, she was an obstacle to me. It was very frustrating. I couldn't understand why she didn't want to fit in as much as I did. And I would, you know, think that she, you know, was just, you know, wanting to portray our whole family as freaks. And why couldn't she just, you know, want to be normal the way I wanted to be normal? Mm. But it just didn't, I didn't understand at the time what she, you know, that her views, her political views, were about, you know, equality.
She was pretty strict, too.
She was. She was strict. And before she came into our lives, my sister and I, we had complete freedom. I mean, we rode our bicycles around the house, and that was normal. And we ate candy constantly, nonstop. And then Rosa appeared and took the candy away. And suddenly we had to do chores. So she really brought a sense of order and discipline, which was both good and yet something I resented.
Yeah.
So she definitely represents, too, in the book, this, you know, imposed order, this imposed discipline.
And going to the movies, you would have to clear it with her, and there was...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, everything. She was really big on permission. You know, if you wanted to get some cookies for dessert after dinner, you had to ask her. And everything was about permission and control. And I think that was also one of her ways of keeping order, was by trying to maintain control over what everybody was doing in the household.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she would read my diary, which was another way of maintaining control, sort of thought control in a way, or so I thought at the time.
Yeah. And also what came out of the radio or what was on the record player, that was also under her view, so to speak.
Yeah.
And tell us the story about, you know, of course, going to Flashdance was out of the realm of possibility, but... She didn't care too much for the soundtrack either, did she?
Well, there's this moment in the book where we loved listening to the radio, listening to music, my sisters and everybody. We loved it because it was, you know, it was escape, basically. And 80s music is terrible. But I loved it at the time, and I was always mishearing lyrics. And there was this, and I write about this in the book, there's a moment when I was singing out loud to the Flashdance song, and the actual lyrics, I think, is this, oh, what a feeling. The actual lyrics are, take your passion and make it happen. And I, for some reason, I misheard it, and I thought the lyric said, take your pants off and make it happen. And I had no idea even what that meant. I thought I was just repeating lyrics. But my stepmother heard me singing that line, and she just freaked out and thought that there was something wrong with the music, with me, and she was really scared that we were, my sisters and I, that we were going to become bad girls, you know, become wayward girls. And so, again, going back to these issues of control.
Yeah. Do you tell these stories now together when you get together with your family, and what does the family think of the book?
Well, I don't know exactly. And I think it's funny because my sister, on the one who's a year and a half older, she remembers almost everything in the same way. Not exactly, but I think everyone remembers events differently. But we don't really talk about my writing, and we don't really talk about the past that much. We sometimes, you know, reminisce, which is to say we dwell on funny or happy moments, but for the most part we sort of avoid delving into previous conflicts or anything that might, you know, approach conflict. So, and to me, there's a lot of conflict in the past. So, Consequently, we don't really talk about our childhood that much.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you say about your family in the book is that the family doesn't talk about the war and those years in Vietnam so much as the domestic details of their lives. And I suspect this is universal, that this is how we recall our personal histories.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. There is comfort, I think, in remembering good times, in remembering those domestic details, like my grandmother's pet cat who had a pet rat. Small things like that can provide, you know, comfort and context. But the war was just too big. There's too much loss, so I can understand they're not wanting to talk about it. But that silence, I think there was a lot of silence when I was growing up, a lot of subjects we were not supposed to talk about, like my mother, we're not supposed to talk about that, like anything naughty, anything sexual, those topics were off limits. And I think in a way that sort of idea of silence continues.
It'd be like Rosa saying, none of your business.
Yeah.
End of discussion.
Was a very frequent phrase.
One of the ways in which you tell your story is through your memories of food and music. Your uncle's listening to American pop music, you listening to pop music, your grandmother's offerings of fruit to Buddha, your obsession with American junk food. When did you begin to see that what you were trying to consume, when did it begin to dawn on you that what you were trying to do was to transform yourself into an all-American girl?
Well, on some level, I think there was a conscious decision. Especially not necessarily through the food, but really through the clothes, the bad fashion of the 80s, and the music, the materialistic trappings. I think that was a conscious choice, that I knew that if I could clothe myself literally in these, you know, neon fashions, that I could become somebody else. But it wasn't till, you know, quite a bit later, starting in high school, that I began to understand food in my life as symbolic and not just literal. But I think, you know, there was always, when I was trying to fit in, there was a clear self-awareness that I would have to actively do things, wear things, read things, behave in a certain way in order to try to get by And that was really what my goal was to get by, to blend in, to be unnoticed, just not stand out.
Hmm. How did your father and your grandmother and your uncles feel about blending in?
Well, I think they were able to make friends and contacts within the growing Vietnamese community in Grand Rapids. I think that was very helpful. There's a significant community there now, and you know, they could be with people who were like them. And I didn't have that experience because I was sort of in between. I mean, technically first generation, but so completely Americanized. I mean, I was 8 months old when we came here, that I was in you know, most regards, a second generation. And so I didn't really have the community access that my father and uncles had. That's one of the reasons why I think I wanted so much to fit in. I mean, my community was school. And when I went to school, all of my friends and classmates were not Asian. You know, they were white, and I wanted to be one of them. I wanted to fit in among them.
How were you treated by your classmates?
For the most part, pretty well. I mean, there were a couple of moments. I mean, school was where I realized that I was different. School was where I first heard racial slurs, where I first, you know, had people make fun of me, and so on. I don't think that's really different from a lot of people's experience in school. But I also made a lot of wonderful friends, but my friendships were always so fraught with tension because I always felt very sort of, I felt unequal. And what my friends were, to me, were always perfect and usually blonde. And you know, they were the kind of girls I wanted to be. They had canopy beds. And I knew I couldn't be one of them. And so I always felt that I was something of a fraud in those friendships.
Hmm. What were your friendships like with children of other immigrants from Vietnam?
I did have a couple of really good friends, Vietnamese girlfriends in the community. The problem, and I saw them at parties on the weekend, the problem was that we went to different schools, and the schools that I attended, there were very few Vietnamese girls. And just, I think when I was a child, proximity really determined friendship. And I just didn't have that many Vietnamese people living nearby to maintain close friendships.
Our guest this afternoon is Biet Minh Nguyen. She is the author of Stealing Buddha's Dinner, a memoir. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Biet, would you like to read from your book? Is there a passage that you would like to share with us?
Okay. I could read the first paragraph of the first chapter, which is called Pringles. My first favorite food, Pringles. We arrived in Grand Rapids with $5 and a knapsack of clothes. Mr. Heidinger, our sponsor, set us up with a rental house, some groceries, boxed rice, egg noodles, cans of green beans, and gave us dresses his daughters had outgrown. He hired my father to work a filling machine at North American Feather. Mr. Heidinger wore wide sport coats and had yellow hair. My sister and I were taught to say his name in a hushed tone to show respect. But if he stopped by to check on us, my grandmother would tell us to be silent, because that was part of being good. "Hello, girls," he would say, stooping to pat us on the head.
Hmm. How did you see those Pringles, those chips in the containers, the container that they came in?
Oh, yes, we love the containers.
Yeah.
Well, the they were magic. The Pringles were magic. Like, we couldn't figure out how they got their shape. They maintained their shape. And yet they were so fragile.
Yeah.
And Mr. Pringle is, you know, both stern and welcoming with this big mustache. And the cans could be turned into piggy banks and they could be carried around. They weren't flimsy. Yeah, they weren't bags. And so it just seemed like when my father brought home Pringles, he was giving us a substantial gift.
Mm.
And they were, Pringles are so processed. I mean, it's unclear where a potato even fits into the scheme. But that was part of the magic, the allure. And it just sort of seemed, you know, that this was this American promise. You can create magic.
I was at the supermarket yesterday and was thinking of you because the first thing that hit me when I came in the door is preparations for the Super Bowl. There's all this junk food
right
at the outset, and there were the Pringles cans. That was amazing.
Lots of different flavors now.
Yeah. There used to be just one, but now it comes in all manner of flavors.
But the shape has stayed the same.
Yeah.
And I've actually always longed to go to a Pringles factory and see how, and I think I'd like to do this, to see how they're created, because I can't imagine it. It is like, in my mind, it still seems like an act of magic.
Hmm. Do you eat them today?
Let's see, when I ate them, let's see, when's the last time? Probably a few months ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't eat them regularly, but every once in a while, I'll get this weird, strange craving. And they're so salty, and they remind me of a former life.
Yeah. Well, it's so strange to think of you in your bunk bed with Pringles and with pickled leeks. Was it leeks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the can was called pickled leeks, but they're not leeks, they're shallots. It really confused me for many years. But yeah, no, I that was my only private space, was my bunk bed. And I would hide food there all the time. Because when you live in a house with, you know, all these siblings and uncles, you kind of have to eat what you can, because otherwise someone else is going to take it.
Mm.
So I would, you know, hide all sorts of food under my pillow.
And one of the ways you would get things out of the kitchen and to the bunk bed was with the help of books.
Yeah.
As, you know.
A shield.
Shield. Mm-hmm. So you were quite a reader as well.
I was. I loved reading from as early as I can remember. I loved reading books. I loved magazines. Remember the first magazine I read was National Geographic. And books were the most wonderful form of escape. And in a way, I was always trying to escape my present condition, my own life. And the books I read were just, to me, fantasy. I mean, Little Women, pure fantasy. Just lives that I wish I could have or I dreamed of being reincarnated into, sort of, you know, girls who seem to have it made. So I loved reading and finding someone else's world, because inevitably someone else's world, someone else's language was superior to my own.
When did you begin writing and expressing who you were, who you are?
Well, I think there's, for me, there was a difference between when I began writing and when I began expressing who I was. I kept a diary when I was a girl, but for a short time, because my mother and my sisters would always read my diary and then make fun of me. And so it was no fun anymore. You can't keep a diary if you know it's not going to be private. So I stopped doing that, and I would write these sort of fanciful stories. But they were never about me. They were always, you know, fantasy. Even though they were realistic stories, they were essentially fantasy, because they were about, you know, beautiful, blonde, or auburn-haired girls. And so I didn't really begin thinking about writing as something that I could do and write about in terms of my own experience until I got to college, pretty much.
And how did it begin there for you?
It began when I was in my first year of college at the University of Michigan. I took an intro creative writing class, and the range of material we read, the poems and short stories, was really inspiring and basically gave me permission in a way. Mm. Made me see what these people are writing about all sorts of things, and they're writing about themselves as well. And then I took an Asian American literature class, and that was really eye-opening for me. I didn't even really know that there was such a thing as Asian American literature, or that Asian Americans could even write literature.
Mm.
So in many ways, I didn't consciously realize it at the time, I think I was looking for permission, which is what I think a lot of young writers do or need to do, is to get validation, to get someone, you know, within another text saying, this is okay to write about, this is okay to pursue.
And also with going to college comes a lot of independence. That was really important too.
Yes, I loved it. I could not get to college soon enough. And partly that was because I always felt very trapped and uncomfortable in my house, not just Grand Rapids really, but just in my family. I never felt that I had any privacy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and again, in college, that was when I read A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf, and that was, you know, eye-opening as well. And that's really what I did want, that I realized when I read it. Everyone needs a room of one's own.
Yeah, a little bit more space than that surface of the bunk.
Yeah.
Where you're really not alone at all. The house was just, you know, really full, which is in a sense good too. I mean, I would,
yeah,
you know, thinking back, we had a pretty large family in a pretty small house, and you're absolutely right, it could be suffocating.
Well,
the only place you could
lots,
be,
yeah,
the only place you could be alone in our house, well, I had a bedroom because I was the only girl, but other than that, it was the bathroom.
The bathroom, yes.
Yeah.
The one room that has a lock.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, I mean the you know, the joy of being in a big family is always having somebody there, and you know, always being able to rely on somebody else. I mean, I love having a big family and siblings, but my siblings didn't seem to have the same issues with fitting in as I did. It was all, you know, sort of heightened for me for some reason. I think it was because I've always felt very ugly, you know, literally and metaphorically compared to them. I always felt that I was, you know, somehow just not getting it, whatever it was, and they were. And so I often felt like I needed to be alone, but needing to be alone in a big house, I mean, a house with a lot of people, was really the same thing as hiding out. So there was a sort of a conflation of being alone and hiding. So it took me a long time to figure out what sort of independence meant to me.
I wonder what it was like. Have you talked with your step-sister, Chrissy, and your brother, Vin? When Rosa and your father married, she had a daughter, Chrissy. Mm-hmm. And then soon after Rosa and your father married, you had a brother, Vin. Have you spoken with them about, you know, have you gotten some, do you have some sense of what their experience was?
I think it was difficult for Chrissy, my stepsister, when my father married her mother. She was 7 years old and had always had her mother to herself. And suddenly, I mean, I think seven is a difficult age, suddenly she had this huge other family, you know, siblings and people like, you know, me, younger sisters, following her around everywhere. And I think it was probably not easy for her. I can't imagine it would have been easy. And I think she rebelled in many ways. There's a chapter that sort of is about her rebellion. And I always looked up to her because she was so pretty and so stylish. She always knew exactly what to wear and what music to listen to. And, you know, I really wanted to be like her. But she was, you know, on her own trying to figure out who she wanted to be. And I think it was a confusing time for her as it was for me, though I didn't see any of that until many years later. Mm-hmm. And my brother, who's the youngest, he's also the only boy, mm-hmm. only son. And so he was very much the favorite child. We all favored him. We all loved him so much. And he was such a sweet, kind child. He's still sweet and kind. As a kid, he was just so generous. Everyone just spoiled him, and it didn't seem to hurt him being spoiled. Mm. And I think it was just being the son, honestly, being the boy. He was given so much attention. But the weird thing is that my sisters and I didn't resent it. We loved having a younger brother.
You and your sister, Anne, are very close in age. Were you close as children?
We were really close when we lived on Baldwin Street, which is the first place we lived, up until Rosa entered our lives. I mean, we did everything together. We always had our arms around each other. But then when we grew up, we really became very different and distant academically, physically, everything. She was pretty popular and really good at sports, and I was not basically any of those. And so we really diverged and had many, many fights and didn't become close again until after college.
Bitmin Nguyen is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Stealing Buddha's Dinner. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got about 5-6 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us this afternoon with a question, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I really appreciate this program. I'm at Clark Lindsay Village now. And now that's a room of my own. But anyway, it's very difficult to transition from your own home to another retirement facility. Do you touch on that in your book? I haven't read it yet. And I'll just listen off the air. Thank you.
Transitions. That's an interesting question.
It is. That's a really interesting question. I think the idea of home is really central to this book and has been really central to my life. I realized when I was writing this book that I had never felt comfortable in any home. I'd never felt at home in any home. And I think there's so much of the self that goes into this idea of what home is. And the only time I ever have felt comfortable was when I actually bought my own home. I think there was this sort of sense of ownership that it was mine now. It's such an American concept, I guess, but that it was mine and that I could be comfortable, and that at any other place I'm just sort of tiptoeing or just squatting. So I think, you know, that's how we decide what makes home ours is such an interesting topic. So that's a very compelling question.
Yeah. Well, you divide your time between West Lafayette and Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
It's strange, actually, because I feel very comfortable in both homes, but they are completely different, aesthetically completely different. And the distance from Chicago to West Lafayette is about 2 hours, so it's not that bad. But being in Chicago is, you know, it's the city, and the energy is completely different. But being here at Purdue is very calming and quiet, and I get most of my work done in West Lafayette and not in Chicago. But I get something of energy in Chicago that I can't get in West Lafayette. So for me, it provides having these two places provides a balance that I need. Although I think, you know, to other people it seems very strange to go back and forth.
Yeah, I would imagine that maybe there's a little bit of fondness for Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Ann Arbor.
Oh, I have great fondness for Ann Arbor in particular. Grand Rapids is sort of a confusing place for me because of my experience there was just so set in the 80s. And that was, it's a very conservative city, and it was especially so in the 1980s. So it's a little bit difficult for me to separate my 80s experience in Grand Rapids with present-day Grand Rapids. And, you know, when I was growing up, I just could not wait to get to Ann Arbor, which is a really lovely liberal college town. And not just that, but the university was where I feel like I discovered so many ideas that I had been waiting to discover, you know, my whole life up until that point. So the university and Ann Arbor really represent a wonderful time for me.
Hmm. Back to Grand Rapids, I would like for you to describe for us 28th Street.
28th Street. I think every town has a 28th Street, which is just this hideous, long strip of commercial properties. Just, you know, every chain restaurant, every awful store is on 28th Street. You know, nothing but parking lots and depressing signage. And it just goes on for miles and miles. And, you know, there are big malls and strip malls. And that, as far as the eye can see, and that's where all the commerce was. So we were there a lot. That's where the Saigon Market was. That's where Meyer Thrifty Acres was. So 28th Street was big in my life, but it was also, I mean, it was good and bad. It was good in that there was all this commercial materialism that I craved. It was also bad because aesthetically it created a depressing landscape.
Mm. What was the Saigon Market like?
It was a tiny store next to a waterbed store.
How 80s?
I always remember that because every time we went to the Saigon Market, I wanted to go jump on the waterbeds. I wanted a waterbed very badly. And it was just Saigon Market was a meeting place where people in the Vietnamese community could gather and they could buy all the groceries that they needed to make the traditional dishes, and just to catch up on gossip and see how people were doing. We went there a lot and always bought packages of dried squid, which, if you've never tried it, is something to try. It's very pungent, very salty, and very smelly.
And the Dairy Cone was there on
my favorite
street.
Ice cream store.
Yeah.
The Dairy Cone.
The Dairy Cone. And your father and uncles were very good to you in terms of, you know, treating you often.
My uncles were bachelors, and they had the greatest life because they could come and go as they pleased. They could eat all the ice cream they wanted, and they did. They ate a lot of ice cream and they drank a lot of pop. And to me, that was access. Yeah. This is good living in America, all that ice cream and pop. And they were very generous. And, you know, they would take us out for ice cream and candy and pop all the time. And I would just feel so lucky.
Mm. When eventually you met your mother's mother, she said to you, "You are an American girl."
Yeah.
What was that moment like?
Well, it was a very difficult moment because, you know, I knew that she existed, but I'd never had known anything about her. And she was frail and did not live in a nice place or area. And I felt a lot of guilt and responsibility. You know, I felt the sort of a crushing weight of the privilege that I had, and to think all those years I'd been so obsessed with, you know, fruit roll-ups and, you know, wearing the right clothes. And here's my maternal grandmother living in pretty bad conditions. And so when she said that to me, it was something that I knew, that I recognized. I knew I was an American girl, not a Vietnamese girl. But it was hard to hear because it, you know, confirmed the distance that she had felt. You know, and it was not an accusation on her part.
Mm-mm.
But for me, it felt like an accusation, that a self-accusation.
Maybe I misread this, but I sensed that there was some pride in her declaration.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I think there's that, too. I mean, that's the weird complication of it, is that, you know, my relatives often look at me and my sister as, it's, you know, we were American in that we were able to leave, we were able to, you know, go out and pursue the lives that we want and have privileges and freedom that they could not have. And so there is that kind of pride, but it's really hard for me to see that perspective in a way, because I keep turning it around in my head as something that makes me feel guilty. So there might be pride in her voice, but for me that pride just translates to, you know, this incredible privilege, and being privileged is a guilt-inducing situation.